Hello there, and welcome. This is Hear Her Sports, and I'm your host and producer, Elizabeth Emery. And this episode is one of the cross-country ski World Cup race reports that we've been creating since the beginning of the season. I highly recommend going back to listen to all of them because they are all so different. Each of the athletes and the coaches offer something interesting about the racing and being on the World Cup tour. Today, joining me is Julia Hayes, one of the Trail to Gold Fellowship coaches we heard about in the race report with Kristen Bourne, and also in her full episode last year. On the episode, Julia explains a little bit more about the importance of the program. And thank you to Julia, because she made a Herculean effort to record with me. When we talked, she was in a lounge at the Amsterdam airport on her way home after 2 weeks with the U.S. cross-country team. She explains what she did while with the team. She also compares working with the U.S. national team with her regular coaching gig with Bridger Ski Foundation, where she mostly works with younger athletes. Julia grew up very active in Colorado and cross-country ski race for Montana State University. In addition to this recent opportunity through the Trail to Gold Fellowship, Julia also coached at the Junior World Championships in Canada last year. While we do talk about coaching in Minneapolis, the main thrust of our conversation was about the first two post-Minneapolis World Cups, Lahti in Finland and the 50-kilometer Holmenkollen in Norway. I did mean to say 50K, by the way, and it is a long race. In the episode, we referenced the overall World Cup standings very briefly. For some context to that, Jesse Diggins is in first place, followed by a strong and gaining Linz Fahn. I think it goes without saying that a main goal for Jesse in the last few races of the season is to maintain that overall lead, which could alter her tactics a slight bit. Well, onward, let's say hello to Julia. Well, hello, Julia. Thank you for making time to talk about Lahti and Oslo World Cups. You really are making time because you're right there in the airport on the way home. So welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's a great way to pass some time. I have about 5 hours here in Amsterdam. So
oh, no kidding.
Not too bad.
Well, great. So we are talking about Lahti and Oslo, but first, can you describe your role on the team?
Sure. So I was one of eight women that was selected to be part of the Trail to Gold Fellowship. This is the second year that they have successfully worked through that program. And it is based on, primarily based on a book that is titled Trail to Gold, that was published after Keegan Randall and Jesse Diggins won gold in the 2018 Pyeongchang Olympics. And what they did was they took interviews and snippets from all the women that have ever represented the United States in cross-country skiing at the Olympic level. And they've taken the proceeds from that book along with the National Nordic Foundation to help fund eight women to be part of what the U.S. ski team is and how, you know, trying to elevate women in coaching and women in male-dominated roles, primarily on the World Cup. And so I was very fortunate enough to be one of those eight women. And that role included being in the wax truck and helping with testing and waxing and, you know, daily ski maintenance, but also in mild coaching roles with Kristen and Matt, the primary 18 coaches. And so it was a really all-encompassing experience, kind of doing a little bit of everything and seeing the way those races really work from an inside perspective, basically.
I have so many questions, but first,
yes.
Is this your first time doing a World Cup with the U.S. ski team?
Yes.
Oh, mm-hmm. What a great opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the book because I keep on forgetting that the proceeds of the book go to support this whole program. And I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
Have you been surprised by the success of this program? I mean, we've heard about it and we've talked about it on the podcast with other athletes, and it just sort of boggles my mind how successful it is and how well it has worked.
Yeah. You know, in reality, I'm I'm not surprised at how well it's worked. Maria Stuper, a few years ago, created the Women's Ski Coaching Association in the United States, and that nonprofit has done so much to elevate women and everybody in ski coaching. It obviously focuses on women, but it has helped with LGBTQ community members, as well as, you know, as well as our male counterparts, and educating them and trying to support them in being allies in supporting women and helping women succeed, because we can't do this alone, basically. So that organization, along with just positive messaging from US Ski and Snowboard, Matt Whitcomb and Kristen Bourne and Chris Grover, the primary ski and snowboard staff, I think it's just really elevated the way that they do business, really. So I'm not entirely surprised. And I primarily work at a regional junior level as a ski coach, and seeing the camaraderie and excitement around women's ski coaching at all levels, from athletes and parents and race organizers and all of these things, that, you know, they see women getting things done and doing it productively and efficiently. And I think that it's just, you know, everything culminating into a really solid base to help promote this Trail to Gold program and people getting really excited about those opportunities.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I love that you're in the wax truck. You're the first person we've spoken to who's been in the wax truck. And I assume that, you know, you knew what you were doing before they threw you in there.
I like to think that I knew a little bit, but I definitely learned quite a bit. Just mostly watching the wax techs clean and apply and think and come up with different combinations to put on skis, whether that's kick or glide or structure. It kind of is just an incredible process to watch, and it's just it's not rocket science, but it can feel like that with all the different products and everything like that. But it was very cool to be part of.
And you had some challenging conditions, I'd say, in Oslo. Is that correct?
Yes, we, I think Lahti, we definitely struggled a little bit more. It was very warm conditions. The temperature in Lahti hovered around 0 to +5 degrees Celsius, and it had been fairly warm and humid leading up to the ski games, and the snow was very sugary and mashed potato-y and loose. And it didn't have a lot of structure to it. And it was, for the classic skiing, we had clister skis going into it, but we definitely struggled a little bit with speed and finding the right combination of products to make the skis go as fast as we wanted them to.
And what about in Oslo? Explain the switching skis and sort of what the decision is about that. Because I did notice that all the U.S. athletes, I think all of them, switched skis halfway.
Yeah. So 50 kilometers is a really long, long ski race. The top women finished in 2 hours and 20 minutes. And the top men finished in 2 hours and 6 minutes. So it's a long time to be racing and a long time to be skiing, especially in more abrasive, icy snow in a classic race in particular, where that kind of snow can shear off kick wax. And so the 50K was 6 laps of an 8.3 kilometer loop. And the strategy behind changing skis is just kind of having freshness underneath your feet. Obviously, over the course of skiing, kick wax and glide product can rub off and diminish over the course of time and over certain kilometers of skiing. So the strategy behind switching skis is finding more speed with your equipment later in the race. So most athletes ended up transitioning skis around after lap three or after lap four. And that was 100% based on strategic plan. You can kind of pick and choose if you have really good skis or if you have skis that are kind of wearing off. You can kind of read the field on what they're doing. But, you know, if you're going up some really hard climbs when you don't have kick wax, you definitely want to get something fresh underneath your feet.
What were you doing during the race when the athletes were actually racing?
Yeah, my role during Homopolen, I was at one of the feed zones with Kristen Bourne, one of the coaches, and we kind of watched the different parts of the course that we could see through the trees, but we definitely were just standing there with various types of nourishment for the athletes, including like water and scratch and different electrolyte drinks to hand to them during their race so they can stay, they can keep their energy up, basically.
Yeah, I mean, 2 hours is a long time, as you said. Right. So what is their nutrition plan for that? And how are they taking bottles every time?
Yeah, so there were three different feed stations around the course. And the reasoning for that is having, you know, the potential to have multiple feeds per lap. But it's also, you know, if you're in a big pack of skiers and you're in the middle, the course was set four tracks wide. And if you're in the middle track, sometimes you can't reach your coach to grab a feed. So having multiple opportunities throughout the course to honor, you know, athlete congestion, basically.
Right.
And so there were three different points, and each athlete kind of has their own ideal for what they do for feeds. A general rule of thumb in cross-country skiing is feed early and feed often, because once you're depleted, it's harder to build your energy stores back up while you're racing versus if you can add to it and then deplete as you're going. And so most athletes we had a primary station for them to take like gels and more substantial forms of feed. And then we had backup plans to in case they were missed or anything like that. But at the feed station where I was, it was definitely mostly liquid feeds of like Coca-Cola and scratch. And we had a couple of pickle juices in there.
Oh, wow. What's the general feeling right now? I mean, were the athletes happy with their race at Oslo? And, you know, Jesse certainly had a main tactic of staying ahead of Lynn Swann. Like, what is their feeling right now after the Homecoming 50K?
Yeah, I think athletes are content with their performance. I know, speaking with Jessie briefly after her race, her limiting factor was her body just really was cramping, and she had a hard time getting rid of those muscle cramps throughout 50K. And, you know, once those kind of start, it's definitely challenging to keep moving at a high pace and a high rate while trying to also relax your muscles at the same time. But she was very happy with her performance, and she's just a ray of sunshine when it comes to doing the sport that she loves and trying her hardest. And she really does, you know, preach everything that about loving the sport and loving what you're doing. And it sucks to have a bad day, but it's part of it, and not every day can be your best day. And, you know, moving forward and taking learning lessons and learning opportunities with you is kind of the most important factor. I know she was definitely proud with how hard she pushed herself. And it was really fun to watch her really dig deep out there.
What have you learned on this trip?
Oh, wow. A ton. Honestly, I've learned a lot about different waxing practices and different ways of applying waxes, and why you would do something over something else. And there's no harm in ever trying something and just to see if it doesn't work. You'd better you know, it's almost better to try something and fail than wonder if it would have done any good, especially when you have a competent staff that is able to do these things in a very efficient manner. I've learned that dealing with adult athletes is remarkably similar to dealing with teenage athletes in terms of helping them through their day and making sure they have all the information they need to be successful, and that coaching is coaching. It doesn't matter who you're with, whether it's you know, someone who's five and stepping on skis for the first time, or these professional athletes that are trying to compete at the highest level. Everyone is here to collaborate and be part of the process, and it's really fun to be able to have a piece in their day to day, because that's what, you know, that's part of being a coach, is just helping people through life, really.
Yeah.
And we, you know, it's like cross country skiing is kind of the avenue that we've chosen to be better people. And that's really what we're trying to do, is just make really good humans and use the lessons from cross country skiing to help tackle adversity and whatever unfortunate things or wonderful things that life throws at you. And it's just this commonality that we all really enjoy skiing, and that's why we do it.
You said that it was the same to coach these professional athletes as it is to coach your juniors, your teenagers. But isn't there something, I'll say particular, about being at the World Cup level? I mean, it just seems like it's, you know, just a whole different level of stress and expectations. And that was really obvious in Minneapolis, I thought.
Yeah, no, I mean, and it's definitely a totally different stadium. There are different factors. There's definitely more tact and strategy. And there's a lot of, the goals are different, right? You know, it's not qualifying for junior nationals. It's like, you know, winning a World Cup, or, you know, being the best in the world. And those aspects are definitely different. But in terms of just, again, like what we're doing and what we're trying to accomplish as coaches and as athletes, it's very similar. It's remarkably similar.
Oh, that's cool. In your response to some of the things I asked before we get on to record, you mentioned the sustainability of ski coaching. Can you explain that a little bit more?
I mean, in terms of, I think sustainability of coaching for me is finding the right people to be around, and the right sport that really limits burnout mental and emotional load. I think that coaching, you know, no one really gets into coaching for the paycheck, and there is a lot of unpaid work that goes into coaching athletes, and not only athletes, but, you know, making sure that the rooms have microwaves, like the hotel rooms have microwaves, and there's a bus that can take someone to the airport, or, you know, there's so many different moving pieces that all fall on a coach. And two, you know, as you go down in age as a coach, you deal a lot with, you know, parents, and you have to manage the stress of a parent making sure that they feel safe leaving their kid with you, and being competent and knowing what you're doing, and being sure that you're doing this and it's filling your cup. It's not draining it, basically.
Right. That makes total sense. Mm-hmm. One more question before we leave. Lottie was the first World Cup after Minneapolis. And so I'm just curious how the team is and what your impression of sort of coming off of that excitement and that buildup, and how has that impacted the team going back to Europe for these last few races of the season?
I know from talking with the team, everyone was just like riding the most highest of highs for Minneapolis. No one could have expected 30,000 people screaming for the wax techs while they were skiing around the course, you know? And so like, I think that was really special for them. Kristen had mentioned at one point this week that it's easy to forget the impact that they have on skiing in America because they're not in America for most of the season. It sounded like it was very special for them to see what skiing in the United States is and has become. And, you know, the US ski team plays a huge role in what that, what the hype is about. You know, people want to cross-country ski, not because cross-country skiing is like the most fun sport in the world. It has a lot to do with the team and with the athletes and how they promote not only themselves, but the sport. And I think they were all definitely emotionally drained from the tears and the joy and the laughter that they experienced while they were over there. And I do know it was real, like Lahti was particularly hard for the team in terms of jet lag and coming back to European time and everything like that. But I think Minneapolis was something that was really, really special for the team and will never be forgotten. And I think it was that way for all the other nations as well. You know, just sitting with other coaches and athletes, everyone was like, wow, who knew Minneapolis could be so wild? Who knew Minneapolis had so much to offer a World Cup? You know, and because in reality, a lot of people think that this Holmenkollen race is like the party scene of the World Cup. And generally it is, you know, people are camping out in the woods, and same with World Cup finals. You know, people are building fires next to the trail and they're drinking and partying and having a big time. And, you know, all these nations, a lot of these skiers have never experienced a World Cup quite like what was in Minneapolis, it sounds like. And it just was something that was very, had a lasting impact on especially the United States ski team, but I think all of the other nations as well, and not to be so skeptical of coming to the States for a World Cup race.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the impact on the wax techs and, you know, the non-racers, because that seemed like it was a really big deal. I was there, and it was true. When the race techs were going around the course, everybody was cheering. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I think that's a really easy way for those individuals to feel cared for on an external perspective. And, you know, it's like they do so much work. And of course, you can say, you know, all of these athletes can say, oh, you know, my tech is just the best. They do so much work. They wake up early. They go to bed late. They clean my skis. They take care of me emotionally and mentally before, during, and after a race. And they do all of these things for me. But I don't think a lot of people don't quite understand how much those wax techs truly care about the athletes. It's not just about making fast skis for them. They want to be part of the athletes' success, and they really are. And so I think it was really cool for them to have that sort of acknowledgement, even if it was, you know, just blaring loud and totally just because everybody was so enthusiastic to be in Minneapolis at that World Cup.
Right. Well, do you want to close us out with any words?
Oh my. Well, I don't know. I'm really excited to. This is my first podcast, so it's kind of fun to be part of and share some things. I do really think that I kind of did a little research on your podcast before we started, and I think it's really cool to be part of something that is really trying to bring women to the forefront of people's minds. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think I really do value what women offer in leadership roles. And I think that it's still a game that we're all playing. And I think everyone's getting a little bit better at it. But I'm really looking forward to continuing to be part of this huge movement that women are making waves. And it's really cool to share that with you.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and congratulations on being part of this Trail to Gold. I think that's awesome.
Thank you.
Good luck in the future.
Yeah, thanks so much, Elizabeth. I hope to talk to you soon.
That wraps up another Cross Country Ski World Cup race report. Thank you, Julia, for filling your hours of waiting at the airport with a Hear Her Sports recording. The Trail to Gold Fellowship program that Julia is part of is groundbreaking. I know few other programs that have shown as significant an impact towards increasing women's involvement in a sport, and specifically in this case, coaching. In my experience, it is often small actions that can make a big difference. Usually, it just takes one person to recognize the importance of actually doing something. Oh, there is another example I can think of. The great cyclocross racer Helen Wyman has a story of an equally impactful small change in episode 117. She's also a mom, so fits into the mini-series of mother and athletes I'm currently working on. Thanks everyone for listening. Be sure to listen to all of the other race reports because they're just so good. We've been getting the chance to meet U.S. athletes like Sophia Laukley, Jesse Diggins, and Novi McCabe, just to name a few. Listeners have sent me such positive responses. I'd love to hear what you think as well. Email elizabeth@hearhersports.com. Go to our website, hearhersports.com, to sign up for the newsletter, listen to all of the episodes, and support the show through Bookshop, Noboso, and through Buy Me a Coffee. If you are new to Hear Her Sports, a huge welcome to you, and I hope you take a look at some of the other terrific episodes. There are lots of skiers, cyclists, runners, along with athletes from other sports you may not know much about. Every guest has so much to offer. Until next time, bye-bye.
Women's Running Stories, where we explore the intersection between running and life. Because every woman who is committed to a running journey has a story to tell, and this is where you'll find those stories. I am host and producer Cherie Louise Turner. I'm a 53-year-old runner, and together with original music by musician and runner Cormac O'Regan, we bring these inspirational stories to life. Please join us to fuel your adventures.